know, there have to be consequences for wrongdoing, and we need to make sure that the judges have the discretion for that.
Governor Walker wants legislation that cracks down on crime. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 15th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering Irma Lee Hickel.
She was very formal and very well dressed and would have been slightly intimidating, except that she was so frank and so friendly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A rise in crime in Alaska has led Governor Bill Walker to seek a bill in the special session next month that would allow more jail time for some thefts and other crimes. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
A recent report found that Alaska saw higher rates of larcenies, robberies, burglaries, and assaults last year. Governor Walker says the report shows the need for the legislature to take action this year.
Clearly, the crime report shows we can't wait till next year. This isn't something we'll get to next year when we can get to it. This is something we need to get to now.
Walker is calling on the legislature to pass Senate Bill 54. The legislation would increase the potential jail time for both Class C felonies and low-level thefts. Until late last year, C felony convictions could lead to 2 years in jail. Under a law enacted last year, first-time offenders could receive probation. Under Senate Bill 54, the sentence could be as much as 1 year.
You know, there have to be consequences for wrongdoing, and we need to make sure that the judges have the discretion for that.
The proposed bill is not based on the social science evidence that led to last year's law. Researchers say reducing jail time is associated with decreases in repeat offenses. One goal of last year's bill was to shift state spending from jailing offenders to spending money on drug treatment and prevention. Attorney General Jonna Lindemuth says the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission used other evidence to recommend the changes in Senate Bill 54.
There was a lot of testimony before the commission, and that is evidence. It may not be the same kind of statistical evidence that resulted in the first recommendations that were being made.
Lindemuth was referring to last year's law.
But we have additional evidence that's in the crime report itself.
She says the proposed bill amounts to minor tweaks to last year's law. Walker has asked Lindemuth to recommend more changes to state law that the legislature could take up next year. North Pole Republican Senator John Coghill says he supports passing the bill. He says the bill's provisions respond to concerns raised by the public about rising crime.
Even though they get outside the bounds of data certainty, certainly the public outcry has been very clear. And so these were answers to that on some of the felony issues.
The Senate passed the bill 19-1 in April, but it never had a hearing in the House. Dillingham Democratic House Speaker Bryce Edgman said in a statement Friday that the House Majority Caucus is committed to seriously considering policy recommendations that evidence shows will make Alaskans safer. He noted that state budget cuts have reduced the number of prosecutors, state troopers, and local law enforcement officers. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Yesterday, we brought you the story of how Kodiak generates almost 100% of its power with renewable energy. The local co-op has managed to do that while keeping electric rates stable. In fact, the price of electricity in Kodiak has dropped slightly since 2000. So can other communities follow the Kodiak model? Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk explains what Kodiak can teach the world and what might be pretty unique.
It seems like no matter where you are in Kodiak, you can look up and see the wind turbines. There are six of them spinning on Pillar Mountain above town. I'm standing beneath one with Jennifer Rich Creek, who works for the local electric co-op. And it is very, very windy up here. You can hear the rhythm of the blades.
You don't realize how big those blades are when you're looking up from down below.
Yeah. Big and beautiful. I think they look like whale bones. They've got this just great curve to them.
giant, elegant, charismatic, the wind turbines are definitely the most visible symbol of Kodiak's quest to go nearly 100% renewable. If the wind is blowing, they might account for 80% of the power used at any given moment. In the utility world, that is a huge number. But over the course of a whole year, wind probably supplies about 20% of the region's power. Rich Creek says the real workhorse is hydro.
Hydro is the key. It was the key for us, and I see it as the key throughout the country.
When the Kodiak Electric Association set a goal of 95% renewable energy back in 2007, it had a major head start. Terror Lake, their hydro project, was built by the state in the 1980s. Ian Baring-Gould works for the National Renewable Energy Lab in Boulder, Colorado. He says many communities don't have that option.
Kodiak is very unique in that it has great hydro resources and a good wind resource, which is really unique and has allowed them to do what they're doing.
But he says Kodiak is still an example. They've proven it's technically feasible to add a lot of renewable energy to a small grid, and that it can make sense economically. Other cities might not have Kodiak's exact combination of wind and hydro,
but they have other combinations, and they might not be able to get to 100%, which Kodiak can do, but they could get to 80% or 40% or 65%.
Baring-Gould says the way Kodiak did it is also a lesson. They built on their hydro step by step, problem solving over nearly a decade. The result is a system that combines wind, batteries, and flywheels, basically heavy spinning masses that store energy as motion. Along the way, they became perhaps the first system in the world to combine flywheels and batteries in this way. Baring-Gould says that process is a blueprint for isolated communities with standalone grids from the Arctic to the Philippines. But Kodiak isn't just an example for small communities. There are lessons for the big grids of the lower 48, too. To understand why, just listen to the news.
Hurricane Harvey hit the coast last night right at just about 10 o'clock, knocking power out to tens of thousands of people.
Hurricane Irma has left millions of people without power, 3.5 million people in Florida alone.
Massive storms like Irma and Harvey and Hurricane Sandy before them can leave tons of people without power. And that's increasing interest in microgrids. Places like hospitals, military bases, and industrial sites want to be able to separate from the larger grid and generate their own power during emergencies. And once you go down that path, there can be a lot of other benefits to being on a microgrid. Brian Hirsch is an energy consultant in Anchorage. He says maybe at times it's cheaper to generate some of your own power.
And then you have some decision making going on to say, well, when does it make sense for me to generate my own power? When does it make sense for me to sell power back to the bigger grid? When does it make sense for me to just shut my stuff down and buy power from the grid like I typically do?
And those kinds of standalone microgrids, that's exactly what Kodiak is, by necessity. Like so many other communities in Alaska, it's too remote to connect to any larger grid. Ian Baring-Gould says Alaska knows how to run the kinds of self-contained grids the rest of the world is just starting to wake up to.
Alaskans have been doing this for 50 years.
Kodiak, he says, just proves you can take it a step further. If you need proof that this is not all pie in the sky, just visit some of the system's largest energy users. Fish processors.
So we call it the slime line just because it's a wet environment.
James Turner manages the Ocean Beauty seafood plant in Kodiak. Inside, it's a blur of bright lights, fish parts on conveyor belts, workers in hairnets and gloves. And then there are the freezers. So many different kinds of freezers.
And then they're freezing halibut.
Oh, God, they're huge!
Plants like this use a lot of power. So the cost and reliability of electricity are a big deal, Turner says. And Kodiak Electric has delivered on both. I asked Turner if it matters to him that his freezers and conveyor belts are run-off renewables.
It is to me, absolutely. Well, it's better for the environment. You know, I mean, we've got to think about our industry as run-off the environment. You know, everything that we do comes out of the sea. You know, there's certain things that we have to burn diesel on. But power isn't one of them.
Nope, it's not. In Kodiak, that's taken care of by the wind and the rain. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Irma Lee Hickel, the wife of former Governor Wally Hickel, died yesterday. Though her husband's outside personality may have overshadowed her at times, Those who knew her say she was a strong woman of faith and family. One of those remembering her today is Haynes writer Heather Lendy. She says she first met Mrs. Hickel at the governor's mansion many years ago. Lendy showed up early for an event, and though they didn't know each other, Irma Lee answered the door.
She invited me in, and I was so surprised that, you know, the first lady was opening the door, basically, and then she said, oh, come on in, and she had me help her set up for the party. We're putting out little dishes of nuts and, you know, the little trays for the drinks and all that kind of stuff, and she was so gracious. It was like going to your grandmother's house.
They got to know each other better when Lendy started writing a column for the Anchorage Daily News, and Irma Lee would send her handwritten notes. Lendy says Irma Lee was motherly, but in a formal type of way.
Irma Lee always reminded me a little of what I thought the Queen Mother was like. You know, she wore those hats and the matching purse and the handbag, and she was disarming in that on the one level, she was very formal and very well dressed and would have been slightly intimidating, except that she was so frank and so friendly.
Lendy says after she suffered severe injuries when she was riding a bike in Haynes and got hit by a truck, she was bedridden, and Irma Lee wrote to her to encourage her recovery, writing that it was up to her to determine how to handle her healing.
And that I could have a good day even if I couldn't move at all. And she said the thing that she and Governor Hickel would do every morning at the breakfast table, sitting, and she said I could do this lying in bed, was to raise my hands up in the air and say, hip, hip, hooray, hip, hip, hooray, today is a wonderful day. And she told me that if I did that every morning, that would be so. And it was. Just imagining the Hickels doing that at the breakfast table made me happy every morning. So I did it. I did what she told me to do, and it worked.
Irma Lee Hickel was 92 when she died yesterday in Anchorage. Governor Walker ordered all Alaska flags to be lowered to half staff. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, trying to separate bears and humans in a national park.
Of course, when you have this many people and this many bears, we can't, you know, we don't like to use the word safe out here. It's you can't promise anything.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration is trying to allow more in-depth studies of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's oil potential. According to a memo obtained by the Post, the acting director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is looking to update a rule that now bars seismic testing in the refuge. Seismic tests would give geologists a more accurate sense of where and how much oil is in the refuge. Currently, it's estimated there's somewhere between 4 and 12 billion barrels of oil in the refuge's coastal plain. In 2014, Alaska sued Interior to allow oil exploration in the refuge. That lawsuit was unsuccessful. Any final decision that would allow companies to drill for oil in the Arctic Refuge must be made by Congress. The state of Alaska has announced the dollar figure for this year's permanent fund dividend. In a release this afternoon, the Department of Revenue says eligible Alaskans will receive $1,100 each when checks are mailed out starting October 5th. About 640,000 Alaskans will get a PFD this year, totaling about two-thirds of $1 billion in cash paid out from the permanent fund's earnings. This year's dividend level was set in the state legislature when it passed its budget in June. Use of unmanned aerial vehicles in the north is the focus of meetings in Fairbanks this week. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems and Integration is hosting industry representatives to talk about UAV-based operations in Alaska and the Arctic.
It's everything from wildlife monitoring to looking at sea ice, infrastructure monitoring, law enforcement support, such as search and rescue, and a bunch of other Alaska-focused issues.
Center Director Kathy Cahill says unmanned aircraft opportunities are growing as the technology is well-suited to Alaska and the Arctic.
The long distances, the beyond visual line of sight, the monitoring of wildlife. So there has definitely been an uptick in business.
The UAF-based center coordinates with entities in Oregon and Hawaii to operate the Pan-Pacific Test Range Complex, one of seven sanctioned by the Federal Aviation Administration nationwide to test integration of UAVs into conventional airspace. Cahill says the Alaska-administered range group recently expanded to include Midwest locations.
What we found is people don't want to go test their unmanned aircraft more than a day's drive from where they're based. So by spreading out, we can bring more people into the Pan-Pacific fold, and that helps fund some of the work in here in Alaska.
This week's UAV meetings are happening at the Wedgewood Resort in Fairbanks through today. Two drivers were killed last night in a two-vehicle accident on the Richardson Highway near North Pole. Alaska State Troopers say 30-year-old Mackenzie M. Barnum and a 77-year-old man, who troopers have not released the name of, died in the crash near milepost 353 after 6:30 p.m. According to a trooper report, the older man was driving his car across the highway and was hit by Barnum's car. Troopers say it's unknown at this time if impairment was a factor in the crash. The bodies of both victims have been sent to the state medical examiner for autopsy. Alaska regulators plan to revisit on-site use of marijuana in cannabis shops around the state in November. Alaska's Marijuana Control Board has gone back and forth on the on-site consumption issue and will take up the matter at its meeting scheduled for November 14th and 15th in Anchorage. Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office Director Erica McConnell says the November meeting will be held at the Denina Civic and Convention Center. Public comments will be taken through October 27th on a proposal that would allow authorized retail marijuana shops in Alaska to provide a place for people to consume cannabis products that they buy. A resolution supporting on-site consumption of marijuana at licensed establishments was voted down by the Fairbanks Borough Assembly at a meeting last night. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, a majority of assembly members thought the resolution was going too far, too fast.
The resolution, sponsored by Andrew Gray, would have supported proposed state regulations that are out for public comment. Gray says he recognizes the resolution might be moot with the upcoming Fairbanks city and borough measures that would kill the local cannabis industry. Gray said he would support postponing the measure until after the October 3rd election. Most of the assembly thought it was important to address it now, though Assemblymember Guy Satley said the resolution will bring people out for the vote October 3rd.
I'm quite sure that it will result in several hundred people, maybe more, voting on this subject at the election who would have not voted if they hadn't been alerted to it by this discussion.
Other assembly members like Matt Cooper felt the resolution and proposed state regulations needed more work. But Assemblymember Catherine Dodge spoke for others when she said the resolution was going too far, too fast.
My sense is they are still kind of getting used to seeing marijuana retail stores on the corners. They're still getting used to us having cultivation facilities. They're still kind of getting used to what our zoning is.
In the vote on the resolution, Assemblymembers Gray, Lawrence, and Tackey supported the measure, saying pot should be afforded the same status as alcohol. Joining Assemblymembers Satley and Dodge in voting against the resolution were Cooper and Roberts. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters, and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, bear viewing. Stepping off of a floatplane and onto the beach at Brooks Camp in Katmai National Park can be disorienting. Where are the falls? Where are the bears? Do we just walk there now? Are some of the many questions. KDLG's Dave Benninger has those answers, as well as what it takes to keep the peace between humans and bears.
So Brooks belongs first of all to the bears and other wildlife. As visitors, we need to let them be wild.
That's from the orientation video that nearly every visitor watches moments after they step off a floatplane at Brooks Camp. Katmai has some ground rules for tourists as they wander one of Alaska's most iconic outdoor spots, famous for its abundant hungry bruins.
Keep 50 yards away from any bear and 100 yards from a bear with cubs. These are minimum distances. Move back.
Keeping a safe distance makes some obvious sense, but Katmai also maintains tight controls on gear and especially food in the area. Ranger Michael Saxton, the lead wildlife technician at Brooks Camp, says the whole program seems to be working.
Overall, we've had very few incidents here at Brooks Camp, and I think largely that is attributable to the fact that we have very strict food control, and we are able to educate every single visitor that comes through here reasonably well.
According to Ranger Saxton, Katmai only counts three bear incidents dating back to the 50s. One was in 1966 when a fisherman cooked his catch next to his tent and left his mess out that night. He woke up as a bear was dragging him away, but another camper intervened and scared the bear off. In 1991, a ranger walking down the old trail was charged by a sow with cubs. She wrapped herself around a tree but sustained some scrapes and a minor bite wound. And the third, Saxton says, is a story.
A story that always seems to have happened right before whatever ranger I'm talking to at the time started working here. I've never found a report on it, so I cannot tell you whether or not it's true, but there's a story of a family that's out here walking on the Brooks Lake Road. Two subadults come running down the road towards them. Mom gets off the road one way, dad gets off the road the other way, and the kid gets left in the middle of the road and got a little bit of a hip check from the bear.
Katmai management feel they have a pretty good track record for an area that mixes 300 to 400 visitors daily with up to 40 brown bears, not counting the cubs. Katmai has added some more staff on site to keep up with added visitation. Around the peak, there may be a dozen interpretive rangers, 5 bear management technicians, and 10 to 12 other staff at Brooks. Rangers like Tandy Stevens keep an eye as tourists leave their orientation and head towards the viewing platforms a mile and a half up the trail.
Right now we have some bears right off the trail up here, and so we're just sort of holding here. I'm going to get a little information.
Brooks Camp has a lodge and campground and even a restaurant with cold beer on tap. It doesn't exactly feel like Southwest Alaska wilderness, and it's easy to slip out of defensive mode as one walks towards the river.
Through the woods.
Copy. And can you give me an update of any other bears in the area?
We have a bear at the upriver end of the marsh near Big Island, and then bears are now at the river between Corner and Point.
This is where we earn our bear pins, and this is a trust. You trust me, and I trust you. So we'll go as a group. It's always safer to walk in groups.
The bridge that crosses the Brooks River can be a bit of a choke point as human traffic gets stopped if bears are near either side. And it's up to the bears how long they choose to linger there. Then for most, it's on to the first of 2 viewing platforms.
Yeah, if you've just arrived and are hoping to add your name to the wait list, we have our little pager system here. I'll write down the name of your party.
That's Ranger Rebecca Nareau, who this day is helping manage the park's policy of only 40 people at a time on the platform directly adjacent to the falls. Visitors can wait their turn at the lower Riffles platform, which still provides ample viewing of brown bears gobbling up salmon. But people come from all around the world to get right up next to that famous waterfall. Kathy Snyder came from North Carolina.
It's my first time out. It's been great. The bears have been hungry, and I got to enjoy them. And then we went down to the lower platform and watched a couple wrestling in the water, so that's been fantastic.
Some in the Bristol Bay tourism industry have been grumbling a bit that Brooks has become too tightly controlled. But Snyder felt the experience was just right.
Oh, absolutely. Lots of fun, and they've done very well. They're keeping a good eye on it, and I'm not worried about my safety at all.
These rangers take their responsibility very seriously. It's what lead wildlife technician Michael Saxton calls part of the Brooks Camp trade-off.
Because we have a large number of people coming out here and a large number of people that don't have guides with them, we need to have a reasonable presence in order to do the best we can to assure safety. Of course, when you have this many people and this many bears, we can't, we don't like to use the word safe out here. It's you can't promise anything, but we do the best that we can. And part of that is having a slightly more controlled environment.
And for a couple dozen brown bears and a couple 10,000 visitors each summer, that doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. For AK, I'm Dave Benninger.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Jody Dillon in Anchorage. Dillon is an environmental scientist who was born in Juneau.
I've been fortunate to be almost throughout the, various regions of the state, but we do a lot of work in the North Slope, wintertime, summertime, for the oil industry, but also in some of the remote native communities up there. So we kind of get to touch every little part of Alaska, so it's a pretty cool job, other than the office part, which still isn't bad when you got a good work environment. A lot of the work I do is just monitoring, former contaminated sites and whatnot, and the stage that those are on is different throughout Alaska. I was doing some work on the North Slope out in Anwar, and the porcupine caribou herd that's out there in the Anwar area was migrating through, and it literally stopped work for an hour while this, 10,000 head of, caribou had to roll through. Well, we just stood there in awe. I love the people here. Everybody seems to be, fairly unified in the pioneer spirit, I guess. Doing the subsistence living things, awesome. Interesting environments throughout Alaska. It's so big, and just the way people adapt and get by. You go to Barrow in the wintertime and you wonder why people live there, but then you see the smiles on their faces and cruising around on snow machines, and that's pretty cool. Raising two boys and my wife and I have the mentality we want them to have the adventures we had, and those are unique.
Jody Dillon lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Benninger and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholz, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Dan Bross, Robert Hannon, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.